Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back, and it is now or never, and that debt is fraud. And it's all about compliance to the Constitution, and I think last time I forgot to remind you that we actually have a candidate that is a champion for the Constitution. His name's Gerald Wistrand, and he is running for auditor in Missouri, and he could use your support. He could use your help, folks. Please reach out. The candidate endorsement page has his endorsement information. Here is a candidate. And oh, by the way, I'm going to have a candidate coming up out of South Dakota that that'll be signing the pledge that'll be moving forward as well. So they're going to start popping up because people are actually, you know, they are serious about it. It's just that I'm way too busy to go and chase candidates. This is where we, the people, need to be holding them, demanding that they do this stuff and so forth. And so we need you as well as them to, you know, be proactive. We need proactive support of the Constitution. Bottom line, folks, you're not going to get your government back and you're going to lose everything if we don't start demanding full compliance of the Constitution. That simple. So with that, that's why we go through the ratification phase. This way we we literally give it to you. This is how the Constitution was defined. If the Supreme Court says or asserts, even, you know, indicates something contrary, they should be rebuked. It is not their job to redefine and to make up as they go along. Their job is to support the Constitution. Just like every person that has raised their arm to the square and legally affirmed or bound themselves by oath to supporting this Constitution. That's simple. So, welcome back, Sean.
Great to be here, sir.
Now, we were going to dive into the General Defense and Welfare Clause by Governor Randolph, and you pointed out that's going to take a little bit of time, but I had faith that you could have done it. But what you're going to say would probably cause me to want to add and elucidate more than obviously there was time to allow. So let's go ahead and hit this baby out of the park right now.
Let's do it. The sweeping clause, as it is called, is much dreaded. I find that I differ from several gentlemen on this point. This formidable clause does not in the least increase the powers of Congress. It is only inserted for greater caution than to prevent the possibility of encroaching upon the powers of Congress. No sophistry will be permitted to be used to explain away any of those powers, nor can they possibly assume any other power but what is contained in the Constitution without absolute usurpation. Another security is that if they attempt such a usurpation, the influence of the state governments will nip it in the bud of hope. I know this government will be cautiously watched. The smallest assumption of power will be sounded in alarm to the people and followed by bold and active opposition. I hope that my countrymen will keep guard against every arrogation of power. I shall take notice of what the honorable gentleman said with respect to the power to provide for the general welfare. The meaning of this clause has been perverted to alarm our apprehensions. The whole clause has not been read together. It enabled Congress to, quote, lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises to pay the debts and provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States. But all duties, imposts, and excises shall be uniform throughout the United States, end quote. The plain and obvious meaning of this that no more duties, taxes, imposts, and excises shall be laid than are sufficient to pay the debts and provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States.
Okay, and he goes on a little bit more and kind of explains this. Now, there's kind of a mixed metaphor here, because he starts off talking about the sweeping clause, right? And do you remember what the sweeping clause is?
General defense and...
Actually, it's the necessary... welfare. So the sweeping clause is the necessary and proper clause. The necessary and proper, the Congress will make all laws necessary and proper to... and then that's what they kind of leave it there. Oh, well, then they can make all laws necessary and proper. Well, no, to carry out the aforegoing powers. Everybody looks at the very beginning, but they can make all laws necessary. I deal with this with all sorts of people that conflate and contort and pervert saying they're patriots. But yet, A. Ralph Epperson loved his book. But the fact that he utters these kinds of imbecilic ideas, to me, just, it undermines this guy, this man's credibility. It's like, this other historian that is conflating ideas and so forth. So here we are, and we're looking at the Constitution very specifically. And the point is that they have very specific powers, and when you read a clause, you have to read the entire clause. In other words, with the necessary and proper clause, it doesn't end with they can carry out all laws necessary and proper, because you have to add to that the following portion of that clause, which, let me pull it up, because it's right here. To make all laws which shall be necessary and proper for carrying into execution the foregoing powers and all other powers vested by this Constitution in the government of the United States or in any government or officer thereof. In other words, there's no semicolon that says to make all laws necessary and proper, semicolon. No, that is one sentence until you hit into execution the foregoing powers, comma, and all other powers vested in this Constitution. So in other words, they don't have the ability to just make any necessary and proper, any law they want, because they deem it necessary and proper. It has to be a derivative of a enumerated power. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. I mean, they put it between two things that define it.
Right.
Like you said, the preamble, then they go through the enumerated powers and they say they can use whatever to the foregoing powers.
Yes.
It's simple English.
Yes. And so there's actually in writing, when you have a foreword and a backword and or a preamble and then a conclusion, when you look at the final paragraph, subparagraph 17, to make all laws necessary and proper, that's really the conclusion or the summation of, these powers that are enumerated. And so it's maniacal men and pernicious men and people who choose to redefine. This goes to the courts. These men, because they feel they have, they're getting away with it. They're getting away with using powers they don't legitimately have. And I'm going to tell you that there's probably a high percentage of all jurists out there today that are alive, that if you ask them and you gave them a lie detector test and said, do you have the legitimate authority to create law from your rulings? They would tell you absolutely yes, and it would not come across as a lie, because they've been taught the lie. We've been taught, we've accepted the lie, we've been living the lie. Well, we have been proving the facts. We have proven that these are lies. The only way we change our course is by accepting the truth and putting aside, putting asunder all lies. Am I wrong?
You're absolutely correct, sir.
Okay. So,
and I mean, just, I hate to go down this road, but the birthright citizenship. It doesn't take you 5 minutes to do a cursory source search to find the debate about the 14th Amendment in Congress. And in several places, it is laid out exactly what the meaning is of what this 14th Amendment was meant for and who it was meant to be. It was strictly prohibited against foreigners. So it was never intended for people to come here and have a child, and a child automatically becomes a citizen, regardless of who you are or where you're from or anything to do with your circumstances. And just like you're saying, they've taken it upon themselves that, oh, well, we've decided that this is what it really means.
No, so what's happened, what had to happen is generations had to accept the idea that if the justices chose to redefine something, they could. In other words, so they could bend the law. The separate
right,
but equal clause.
The Fourth Amendment with Roe v. Wade.
Or the 14th Amendment wrote in Plessy v. Ferguson shortly after, because it didn't take long for them to start attacking the 14th Amendment. And it was the Plessy v. Ferguson case that laid out the welcome mat, the red carpet for the Jim Crow laws, all unconstitutional. You have no right to basically create a caste system and legally and constitutionally get away with treating one person differently under a law as you would treat another person. The fact that the court said separate but equal was redefining that concept of equal protection under the law. It's, you know, I get into these debates with, you know, at a level of morality that I just, it's frustrating. I mean, how is it that we would want to see the 14th Amendment? Because there are people that say the 14th Amendment should never have applied the Bill of Rights to, you know, to the states. What part of the Bill of Rights do you not like? What part of the Bill of Rights do you think would, you know, would be better not being provided to the states? Because the states weren't doing it. And so, because after the Civil War, they were literally oppressing, killing, and doing also, and look at with Plessy v. Ferguson, and treating, you know, blacks or freedmen as second-class citizens. The court was the instrumental tool in ensuring oppressive measures could be embraced, and they did get embraced, and racism became so popular because it helped allow and it helped grow and fester this divisive paradigm in America. Had Plessy v. Ferguson been shot down by Congress? But no, what ended up happening was we were overran by the British paradigm and their influence, and the divisive tactics of Britain were once again, you know, being levied and embellished on American soil. That's why the Organic Act of 1871 started the corporations and the thievery and robbing of our precious properties and our, I'll just say, our finances, our money, our gold. And they did it without really fighting a war. They just bought us out politically because we were for sale. Folks, as long as you keep on electing people to say, hey, let me get in there because, you know, I can bring you the compromise home that you need. Yeah, that who needs? Those who have the most money wins the compromise. Or dictates the direction of the compromise. If you haven't seen The Swamp, if you haven't seen how the lobbyist organizations, corporations, and so forth, the globalists, pay for the decisions being made in Congress, then you're completely oblivious to how corrupt your congressmen are. They get paid for every vote in every committee. They get paid to vote one way or they get paid to vote the other way. This is one of the reasons why many Republicans vote the other way, because there's more money in that direction. And then they have to calculate what can they get away with voting that way so that they can walk away with money. CMR walked away with, you know, tens of millions of dollars that she made by selling and compromising us out. And she's our congresswoman. She was our congresswoman for several years. And I had a problem with her. I knew what she was doing. And you should have a problem with every single congressperson in there because they're doing it. All of them are doing it. I don't know. I don't know about Macy. I don't know the issues to what level. But as far as I see, I never saw Macy stand up and demand that the militia be called forth to repel the invasion. So he's equally, not one of them, not even Cruz, not even Rand Paul, have stood up on the floor of their house of legislation and demanded that the execution of the repelling of invaders commence immediately per the Constitution. Not one. So as far as I'm concerned, they could all go. They all have blood on their hands. But the people that are, it's like gloves. Every citizen of the United States is wearing blood gloves. It's that thick on your hands, folks, because you're not holding them accountable. You're not learning, or at least you're not, I'll call it scrutinizing, discerning, and differentiating how important this really is, and then demanding and finding, because it's not about the Second Amendment. Those fools are running around on these myopic issues of the Second Amendment. All they're doing is they're turning their back on the rest of the Constitution, which is allowing the invasion to occur, which is allowing the importation of Islam and allowing the communist revolution to continue. As long as you got your guns, though, yay, you're okay now. You still got your guns. What? Look at the damage that's being done while all of these myopic organizations are turning their back on the rest of the Constitution, only protecting your right to have arms or only protecting your religious freedom. And even those things are being compromised because they want to cherry pick and say, this is the one thing we need to protect, when the simplest thing to do is abide by all of it. Not one word, not one clause, not one part of the Constitution is to be violated, or you're gone. They're actually the champions of allowing all sorts of compromise as long as you don't cross their line. So who's your enemy? That's right. These conservative organizations that are basically functioning myopically, these conservative organizations that are functioning, dare I say, to say, hey, the way we see it, the way we interpret it, like the John Birch Society, the 10th Amendment Center, they actually, because they want to be close, I don't care if my behind is never invited to CPAC. I don't care if I'm never invited to any of that crap. Because if you're invited, that means that you've been compromised, because they see you as an ally, that you're at least, you're doing good, and you're allowing the other compromises to go through. Folks, you need to start understanding that we have to demand full compliance. And this is why you need to start getting your county legislators to basically commit to you and support you and help you educate your citizens, have town hall meetings, and build and develop a county, parish, borough movement, because that's the only thing that's going to save us. So back to this beautiful thing called the ratification debates. Now, Mr. Monroe, James Monroe, now pipes up, and this is an AF note. That means he's an anti-federalist. And I highlight this because I believe this is where he might be talking about the oath of office. Let me just see here. Well, let's just go ahead and read it because this is an interesting point, because James Monroe actually spoke in favor of this oath, but I don't know if this is it right here. Go ahead.
What is the object of the division of power in America? Why is the government divided into different branches? For a more faithful and regular administration, where is there a check? We have more to apprehend from the union of these branches than from the subversion of any, and this union will destroy the rights of the people. There is nothing to prevent this coalition, but the contest which will probably subsist between the general government and the individual governments will tend to produce it. There is a division of sovereignty between national and state governments. How far, then, will they coalesce together? It is not to be supposed that there will be a conflict between them. Is it not to be supposed that there will be a conflict between them? If so, will not the members of the former combine together? Where, then, will be the check to prevent encroachments on the rights of the people? There is not a third essentially distinct branch to preserve a just equilibrium or to prevent such encroachments. In developing this plan of government, we ought to attend to the necessity of having checks. I can see no real checks in it. Let us first inquire into the probability of harmony between the general and individual governments, and in the next place, into the responsibility of the general government either to the people at large or to the state legislatures. As to the harmony between the governments, communion of powers, legislative and judicial, forbids it.
Okay, so one point he's making, which I highlight in green, is there is a division of sovereignty between the national and state governments, because what is being granted to the federal government is for the federal government alone that sovereignty over declaring war and regulating commerce of foreign nations. These few things granted to the federal government, they are the sovereigns over. All other things, the state governments are sovereign over. All other things, as long as the people have delegated that sovereignty to that state government. In other words, in their constitution, did they grant general powers to the state, or did they enumerate powers to say, you have these powers? And did they go to the detail of the type of powers and what they could exercise and identify what those are? In many cases today, that's exactly what's happened. There are some general powers that are being granted in some respects in state government. For the most part, they're enumerated. And as we look at this concept that he's basically laying out, that there's this ability to create this mutual benefiting coercion. It's not that that can't happen. It goes down that same vein as somebody with this kind of power can exercise unrighteous power and or violate that power and assume more power. And therein lies the rub, because that's been stated, and this is just a new way of stating the same thing. That, yes, where power is granted, power can be abused, where the federal government can actually start corrupting the states. Well, the states have to be corruptible. If the states are corruptible, then that's your problem. And if the federal government is trying to corrupt the states, that's a different problem, but it's still a problem. But when they all are corruptible, then we all got problems. We'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. So the system, or I should say the Constitution, is perfect. The problem is that the people that we elect at any level of government isn't perfect. They're corruptible. They're capable of doing things that will violate, on and on and on. So the absolute check has to be we the people. And until we the people start wanting to wash the blood off our hands, it's only going to get worse. The blood's just going to get thicker. Anywho, Mr. Marshall, soon to be Chief Justice Marshall in 1800, then takes a point and stands up in response. And oh, by the way, Marshall and Monroe are akin or friends. And as a matter of fact, Monroe knows Alexander Hamilton as well, because all three of them served in the Revolutionary Army. Madison didn't. And this is one of the reasons why Madison had a political advantage over Monroe, because he didn't serve, and so he was in the people's eyes. But Monroe did have this affiliation with these men on the backside. Now, Monroe was a man of good character, one would like to think, but when you look at what happened in his last term of office, or actually under his presidency, it's unfortunate that those things happened. The Missouri Compromise, the Land Act of 1820. Anyway, let's go ahead and dive into what Mr. Marshall basically says in response to Mr. Monroe. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, I conceive that the object of the discussion now before us is whether democracy or despotism be most eligible. I am sure that those who framed the system submitted to our investigations and those who now support it intend the establishment and security of the former. The supporters of the Constitution claim the fide of being firm friends of the liberty and rights of mankind. They say that they consider it as the best means of protecting liberty. We, sir, idolize democracy. Those who oppose it have bestowed eulogiums on monarchy. We prefer this system to any monarchy, because we are convinced that it has a greater tendency to secure our liberty and promote our happiness. We admire it because we think it a well-regulated democracy. It is recommended to the good people of this country. They are, through us, to declare whether it be such a plan of government as will establish and secure their freedom. Permit me to attend to what the Honorable Gentleman Mr. Henry has said. He has expatiated on the necessity of a due attention to certain maxims, to certain fundamental principles from which a free people ought never to depart. I concur with him in the propriety of the observance of such maxims. They are necessary in any government, but more essential to a democracy than to any other. What are the favorite maxims of democracy? A strict observance of justice and public faith, and a steady adherence to virtue. These, sir, are the principles of a good government. No mischief, no misfortune ought to deter us from a strict observance of justice and public faith. Would to heaven that these principles had been observed under the present government. Had this been the case, the friends of liberty would not be so willing now to part with it. Can we boast that our government is founded on these maxims? Can we pretend to the enjoyment of political freedom or security when we are told that a man has been, by an act of assembly, struck out of existence without a trial by jury, without examination, without being confronted with his accusers and witnesses, without the benefits of the law of the land? Where is our safety when we are told that this act was justifiable because a person was not a Socrates? What has become of the worthy members' maxims? Is this one of them? Shall it be a maxim that a man shall be deprived of his life without the benefit of law? Shall such a deprivation of life be justified by answering that the man's life was not taken secundum artem because he was a bad man? Shall it be a maxim that government ought not to be empowered to protect virtue?
Okay, so obviously he was responding to Henry, not Monroe. I was wrong. But he does lay out this concept, again, that it's the character of the people, not necessarily the people we're electing. That's important. But what I'm trying to point out is if the people are not vigilant in watching and ensuring that these guys who are in government are doing what they're supposed to be doing, then we're not doing our job. Are there better ways? Absolutely, there are better ways. There are ways, and there's many organizations that go through and give you a report card on all of your legislatures at the state house. Who's doing that at the county? We have people that are doing it supposedly for us at the federal level. But I believe that the hands and the institutions and individuals and so forth can and are equally corruptible. So as we go down a little bit further, Mr. Marshall then talks a little bit about this concept of interposing. Go ahead.
The honorable gentleman has asked if there be any safety or freedom when we give away the sword and the purse. Shall the people at large hold the sword and the purse without the interposition of their representatives? Can the whole aggregate community act personally? I apprehend that every gentleman will see the impossibility of this. Must they then not trust them to others? To whom are they to trust them but to their representatives, who are accountable for their conduct? He represents secrecy as unnecessary and produces the British government as a proof of its inutility. Is there no secrecy there when deliberating on the propriety of declaring war or on military arrangements? Do they deliberate in the open fields? No, sir. The British government affords secrecy when necessary, and so ought every government. In this plan, secrecy is only used when it would be fatal and pernicious to publish schemes of government.
Okay, so now we're going to go to Mr. Nicholas, and this is a long list of points. As he was listening, he made these, you know, bullet, boom, boom. This was brought up, this was brought up. And so what he has here is a stack of cue cards or a stack of notes that he starts using to disassemble either Henry and or Monroe and any of these men and some of their arguments. And you will see, because I'm not sure how warm and fuzzy John Marshall makes you feel when you listen to what he says. But when you listen to what he says and you contrast it to what he says as a jurist, you'll actually find conflicts where he says something very definitively that the judges, the courts, the jurists are, you know, bound to, you know, secure and protect that Constitution. And then when he's doing it, well, you know, we have this greater, you know, responsibility of, you know,
evolving and doing what's necessary and proper, because he starts exploiting the sweeping clause. He starts using those things literally as fulcrums to start changing, moving, and redefining. Marshall was a scoundrel. John Marshall was a scoundrel, but he was second to only Alexander Hamilton. Now, with Mr. Nicholas, let's talk about preferential treatment. Now, you've heard me say this, that the federal government cannot create preferential treatment. They cannot choose to say, we're going to choose this port, or this port. And I'll give you a good example. And what should have actually happened, because you can help me out, because I think you know a thing or two more than I do about New Orleans. I think that the New Orleans has a dangerous amount of preferential dependencies, or I should say preferential treatments regarding the importation of energy, regarding the importation of certain types of goods and commodities, to where if the port of New Orleans goes down, if it can't function, it is going to be astronomically bad news for America. Tell me if I'm wrong.
Oh, no, you're absolutely right.
And that should never have happened. That should never have happened. The federal government should have kind of been making sure that the states weren't actually obtaining these preferential advantages over others.
Well, I mean, I don't understand how you can avoid that in a certain situation. I mean, when you think about the port, there is no other port of New Orleans. So are on the you supposed Eastern, to on the, ignore its, well, so you, its are, importance because so you no, don't no, be so, preferential?
So what are you saying? Yeah, there's only one port named the Port of New Orleans. I don't if that
No, what I mean is there's only one port with the access that New Orleans has, both to the interior and to international trade. So, because of the situation that the city is okay. in.
So
that
I,
the port is in.
Well, so I understand that. It New Orleans became the western port for the United States because the Mississippi was a literally a highway going up and down to help expand and right. to make the availability there. But it's not a matter of whether New Orleans did play that integral role. Strategically, there should have been, other places, because when you look at the fact that Georgia and many of the eastern seaboard states, Florida and so forth, are equally recipients because it just comes into New Orleans instead of, and I don't even know if it even goes into New York. There are certain things that literally are only coming into New Orleans.
Okay, but again, it's because of the natural just happenstance. I mean, just the facts of the matter.
Yeah.
That you have the river and access to the interior.
If you have a strategic plan, it's just this, kid's rhyme or what have you. You don't keep all your eggs in one basket. You make sure you have redundancies. You make sure that you never have single point failures in a system. And so the question is, and I'm going to tell you why and how it happened, is because of the federal government. The federal government was not to allow this to happen. They were supposed to ensure that it wouldn't happen. But they had everything to gain when their job was to help secure the collapse of America. This is one of the reasons why they've been bending over backwards to get as many illegals or invaders into America. They're not here securing us from these types of real problems of an invasion, single point failures. They've been setting it up.
I get that.
Okay. So
the point here is, constitutionally, the federal government should have been, you know, trying to be far more proactive in ensuring that other mechanisms were done so that we wouldn't have these types of dependencies. Let me ask you this. Historically, because you heard of peak oil. You've heard the term peak oil, right?
Yes.
Okay. When was the first time peak oil was thrown out to create a fear factor in politics?
I don't know. Could it have been in the early 70s, maybe?
Yeah, that was one of the points in time. It also was kind of later in the 90s and early 2000s. But I think the first time peak oil was thrown out, I believe, was in the 1920s, when all of a sudden more and more cars started becoming, you know, available and the use of it. And that's when they,
the illusion of scarcity.
Yeah, yes. But this was, you know, to try to thwart, you know, the dependency on cars for the giving up of the horses. In other words, there were other industries that tried to use, because they would get data and they would, you know, create the paradigm or create this image that based on this data, you know, we're set up for a bad thing. My point is that as we looked at peak oil, just like as we look at the port of New Orleans, because when was New Orleans being recognized as possibly the Mississippi River rerouting and those types of things to where we would be decimated? When did those conversations first start happening? Because
I'm not sure, but I know exactly what you're talking about. That's right. Why they did all the engineering.
The engineering dams. Right. So they're doing the dams, but they're not changing the distribution and or encouraging, you know, other forms of offloading the oils for going to other ports and so forth. Because there's and I understand the complexity, that there's a lot of money involved. There's a, you know, when you start doing things like that, you start playing in other people's little, you know, sandboxes, and they get upset and people die, you know, guns come out, you know, you have turf wars. I understand. But let's read this, because this is where Nicholas kind of talks about how important it is to ensure that the federal government be void of. It's one thing for the states to start creating these things, but it's another thing for the national security and for, you know, when you start seeing and saying, hey, hold on here, we have way too much dependency on this area. The federal government should have actually used a national security, you know, measure and said, you have to start, you know, moving, or other ports have to start stepping up to, you know, because that's a single point failure. We can't have that. That would cripple us as a nation. It would really hurt us. So let's go ahead and read this one.
But I mean, as far as strategy is concerned, yes, you have to think about the fact that if an enemy does decide to invade us, they're not going to try to invade us through the Gulf Coast of Alabama, because they have no access to the interior. Just like in the Civil War, capturing New Orleans was a very strategic issue because of the access, to just the natural access. So, I mean, I understand what you're talking about with things you shouldn't have preferential treatment to one state or this state, like with the cod fishery bounty. That was, you know, exactly. And I wanted to ask you about that on another part that we were talking about. Why didn't they just provide for the training of the sailors through the funds for the Navy out of the Treasury, instead of trying to do these bounties to train seamen for possible use in the Navy? I get that part of it, because they were given preference to an industry. But as far as strategic thinking, you're going to be more concerned with protecting a port, the Mississippi River, than you would the Mobile River, because the strategic importance of it for defense is much higher.
I understand that. I get that. I'm saying that after the Civil War, and as things continued on, And when we started recognizing that this real potential of a massive shift where an existing port would all of a sudden be non-functional, that the ramifications of that became pretty significant. And it's not like it was something that just was 5 days ago. It wasn't a year ago. We're talking right. about a half century, if not more. And the question is, well, okay, down in, what is it, Galveston, Houston, or over to Tampa, there are other areas that there could have been, you know, say, you know, corporations, even corporations would have been smart in, you know, setting up a redundancy because they would be equally impacted. But they didn't. Everybody just, they held the line. And I'm going, this, it reeks. It reeks to me. But let's, but on the cod fishery thing, when did Annapolis get established as the training ground for the Navy?
I'm not sure.
It was pretty early because they did want to have regular training for the officers. They didn't have much training for the seamen, the Marines, and so forth, other than, you know, some combat training, arms training, you know, and but they did have some basic training, boot camp, what have you. They actually, Annapolis did get established as the, you know, the first training for the Navy and the Marine Corps. So
1845.
There you go. And at that point in time, and that right there, I'm trying to remember, what's the school for the Army? West Point. When was West Point established? This proves to you folks, the Constitution took a sidestep for politics when it came to our military. Go ahead. West Point.
One moment, sir.
That's fine.
It's not that fast.
Yeah.
1802.
Huh. Why so fast? Because
Thomas Jefferson.
It was under his watch, yes. But because there were so many people prominent that had Army background, not Navy, that they said, we have to have this. We have to have West Point. We've got to have this. When we look at, you know, the Army's role in our national security was secondary to the Navy. Thomas Jefferson actually mocked John Adams as the vice president. When he was vice president under John Adams, he mocked John Adams for, you know, putting so much money into the Navy. And then he was the first one quick to use it, and he realized, okay, we need to do something. But he still didn't fathom how important the Navy and our national security was on that. And I've on the record for saying that we, you know, we have this problem all more to politics instead of actually understanding the constitutionality and the importance of why the Constitution was done the way it was. So, I mean, those institutions should have been reversed. Annapolis should have been done in 1802 and West Point maybe down the road. But there was so much money and so much focus on, you know, the land. Oh, we got to have our soldiers and standing army. It's just like, wow, did they forget the whole point of, you know, this Constitution and the importance of this national security system called the Navy? Anyway, did I answer both questions? I think I did.
Yes, sir.
Okay. All right. So let's go. Let's look at what Mr. Nicholas has to say about this preferential treatment and so forth.
There are many strong reasons to expect that the adoption of this system will be beneficial to the backcountry, and that their interests will be much better attended to under the new than under the old government. There are checks in this Constitution which will render the navigation of the Mississippi safer than it was under the Confederation. There is a clause which, in my opinion, will prohibit the general government from relinquishing that navigation. The fifth clause of the ninth section of the first article provides, quote, that no preference shall be given by any regulation of commerce or revenue to the ports of one state over those of another. If Congress be expressly prohibited to give preference to the ports of one state over those of another, there is a strong implication that they cannot give preference to the ports of any foreign nation over those of a state. This will render it unconstitutional to give Spain a preference to the western country in the navigation of that river. They may say that this is a constrained construction, but it appears to me rational. It would be a violation of true policy to give such a preference. It would be a departure from natural construction to suppose that an advantage withheld from the state should be given to a foreign nation.
Okay, so he's actually making these implications strictly on the navigation of commerce at this juncture. But when you look at the bigger picture of the concept of preference, and you know, whether that be one state to another state, one state to a foreign nation, corporation, so forth, when we look at the strategic interests of the Union, there should have been a mechanism. And this is where I think the Senate really failed. The U.S. Senate truly failed because they were more concerned about compromising politics than they were about looking at what was strategically best. Because I'm here to tell you the fact that we're looking at our energy system, our vehicles and everything else is all a huge part of the global compromises of what they're willing to allow us to maintain while they have plans in migrating us in a direction that will not suit us or be in our benefit at all. And so but they're not supposed to be doing it anyway. Who should be? It should be the Senate. And who should be driving the Senate? Not the globalists. But the globalists are controlling the Senate because your state legislatures are not demanding their suffrage in the Senate. If we had the state legislatures demanding their suffrage, then they'd make sure that their energy needs would be met, that we wouldn't be seeing the sunsetting of petroleum, natural gas, or anything else, and that we would actually have true strategies and plans of making sure America can serve and sustain itself. But instead, the globalists are telling us which way to go and the preferences at that scale today, when that's not to be happening. As a republic, the states need to be making those decisions, and those decisions really need to be made in the Senate. Prior to that, though, they need to be made in the state legislatures. But we've been sucked into these compromises, and what happened is, so there was this evolution part. I mean, ran out of time, so I'm going to have to do a go back to talk about, you know, how we meandered into all of these different compromises just due to the slow evolution of life as the Republic. Anyway, folks, I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.